This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture. I'm Hezrul Ashraf, alongside Juliet Jacobs and Dashran Johan. 20. That's the number of people injured in Indonesia's latest church bombing in the port city of Makassar on the island of Sulawesi. And this unfortunately happened against the backdrop of Palm Sunday, which was yesterday, and it's the first day of the Easter Holy Week. So today we take a look at what's behind this tragic incident and ways the Indonesian government is addressing terrorist threats to improve the country's security.
That's right. So you have any thoughts that you'd like to share with us, you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Alternatively, you can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899.
Yes. So as you said earlier, Hez, 20 people were tragically injured yesterday in a also equally tragic explosion at a church in Indonesia's city of Makassar, a city in Sulawesi, an island northeast of Java. The explosion was set off by two individuals, a man and a woman, at the entrance of the Sacred Heart of Jesus Cathedral, which is a Roman Catholic cathedral.
Yeah, the incident happened at around 10:20 a.m., according to Inspector General Raden Prabowo Argo Yuwono, who is a spokesperson for the Indonesian National Police. So this was just as the mass for Palm Sunday, a holy day for Christians, was ending. No one aside from the suicide bombers died from the explosion, and a few people attended the mass due to COVID-19 SOPs. So this was mainly due to the fact that the two perpetrators were stopped at the entrance of the church compound's gate.
Yeah. So President Joko Widodo, better known as Jokowi, condemned what he called an "quote unquote" act of terror. He also emphasized that, I quote, "the state guarantees the safety of religious people to worship without fear." The president subsequently ordered the police to, and I'm quoting him again, thoroughly investigate the perpetrators' networks and dismantle the networks to its roots. And on that note, police are still investigating, you know, if certain militant groups were behind the attack. But that being said, though, you know, this isn't the first church bombing that's happened in Indonesia in recent years.
Yeah, so just a little bit of background. There have been several attacks on churches in the past decade in different parts of Indonesia. So in 2018, three churches were bombed in the city of Surabaya in East Java, and it claimed the lives of nearly 30 people and injured 50. And if you remember, this was especially significant and really just shocking, right? Mm-hmm. Because the suspects came from a family, you know, the parents and children, three of whom were just teenagers, and the youngest was only 8 years old. And there was also a tragic incident in Solo back in 2011 that claimed one life and injured at least 20 people.
Yeah. Generally, though, the terrorist attacks have been relatively frequent in Indonesia and have targeted various communities. So that same year in 2011, a mosque in a police compound in the city of Cirebon was attacked by a suicide bomber, injuring nearly 30 police officers. So now, of course, many of us will remember the Bali bombing in 2002 that killed 202 people. Most of them were foreign tourists. Now, many of these attacks have been linked to the militant terrorist group, the Islamic State, or groups that are affiliated with them.
Yeah, and looking at what the government's done, the Indonesian government has taken a few steps to address, you know, what's seen as a growing security threat. In 2018, for instance, they passed an anti-terror law so that the police can conduct preemptive arrests and detain people who are suspected of being members of any group that's declared a terrorist organization. Mm. They've also expanded the role of the military to strengthen domestic security. And, you know, in general, the two largest Islamic organizations, the Nahdlatul Ulama and Muhammadiyah, you know, have been quite vocal in condemning terror attacks by militant groups. And, you know, they've helped to reinforce a sense of unity in the country, which is important, especially since Indonesia is a very large and very, very diverse country.
Yeah, exactly. And so as well, we know that Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim majority country, with a population of 270 million people. Around 87% are Muslim. But there's also a sizable Christian community. That's around 10% of the population, or nearly 30 million people, as well as Buddhists, Hindus, and many more.
Yeah. And to unite these different populations, right? Indonesia emphasizes the concept of Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, or in English is unity in diversity. It's inscribed in the Pancasila, which is the equivalent of our Rukun Negara, as well as Indonesia's federal constitution.
Yeah, so to discuss what exactly happened in Makassar and how else the Indonesian government is tackling terrorism, this growing threat in its own borders, we've got political analyst Alden Iswanto on the line, and he's joining us from Jakarta. Alden, thanks for joining us today. Now, tragically, and very unfortunately, this isn't Indonesia's first church bombing in recent years. What has been the frequency of attacks against the Christian community in the past decade? I mean, has this always been an issue, historically speaking?
Thanks, Israel. Yeah, unfortunately, the incident that happened in Makassar yesterday was very sad and tragic for the country. And there has been attacks on religious communities over the last few years. And unfortunately and sadly, it happened, I think, every few years. So before this, back in 2018, there was a notable attack on churches in Surabaya, which involved whole families, which really surprised everyone. And also back in 2017, there was an attack on a church as well in Samarinda, East Kalimantan. And that one was also suspected to be religiously motivated. So this is actually an incident that has a pattern and happened almost every few years, unfortunately. Yeah.
And for people who are unfamiliar, what does the city of Makassar look like in terms of its religious demographic distribution?
Sure. So Makassar itself is located in Sulawesi, which is in the eastern part of Indonesia. So for people who are familiar with the division of Indonesia, the eastern part of Indonesia is usually populated with Christians. And Makassar itself is quite a unique city in the way that even though a majority of the populace are Muslims, but they do hold a very significant and strong, strongly linked Christian community. I think Christians amounts to around 15-17% of the population, which is actually quite high for an Indonesian city. And the Christian populace in the city itself, they hold a very strong character, and hold a very strong sense of community. And if you go to Makassar itself, you can sense that it is very different to what you normally would see in Jakarta or you would see in Jogja. And for the attacks on religious communities that had happened previously, there is no clear distinct pattern because Surabaya itself is mostly a Muslim populated city with some significant Christian population, but it is still a majority Muslim city. So this is not an attack of a minority Muslim community against a larger, wider, a non-Muslim community. So it's the pattern itself, it's difficult to discern. Yeah.
And what was the reason behind the latest incident in Makassar? I mean, we understand that the police are still investigating it, but are they in any way connected to previous attacks like the ones in Surabaya?
So I think for this particular attack in Makassar, to claim a connection, I think it's still very early to tell. I think the police is still conducting investigation in these early stages. But they do suspect that the two perpetrators, they are linked with the GAD terror group, which is the Jamaah Ansharud Daulah, with links to the Islamic State. And also the bombing in Surabaya, the family was linked with a GAD cell as well. So they have that GAD link, but to connect the two incident would be a bit too premature. But I think to understand the incident itself, you have to understand how GAD itself is structured. They are a territorially organized radical group across Indonesia, and they are separated into various regions and then branches, and then the smallest one would be cells, and they do have sleeper cells in various regions in Indonesia, including in Makassar. and it is somehow hierarchical, that it does have a chain of command. But at the same time, it is also a loose organization that allows branches, cells, and individuals to operate independently from each other. So it's very difficult to draw a common thread among these incidents. But if we look at January this year, the Densus 88 counterterrorism squad actually raided hideouts of suspected JAD cells in Makassar. And I think around 17 or 20 were arrested, and two were actually killed on spot. And these group were actually connected with the bombing in Jolo in the Philippines back in 2019. So in a way, the cell in Makassar has that regional link. And I think police for now suspect that the bombing yesterday happened as a retaliation from the suppression from the police.
All right. On that note, we do have to go for a quick break. We're speaking today with political analyst Alden Iswanto. We'll talk about the implications this attack will have on things like investor confidence and more. Keep it here on the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture. I'm Hazrul Ashraf, alongside Juliet Jacobs and Dashran Johan. Today we're discussing the tragic church bombing that happened yesterday in Indonesia in the city of Makassar with a political analyst, Alden Iswanto.
That's right. And if you have any thoughts that you'd like to share with us, you can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899.
Yes, well, Alden, thanks for staying with us, though. So before the break, you mentioned that in Indonesia, the number of attacks against churches in particular has grown. And you explained that part of this is a way for militant groups to retaliate against police efforts to clamp down on these groups. But what are the implications of this latest incident? You know, what does it represent? Is it symptomatic of religious tensions in Indonesia, or does it stem from something else?
Yeah. So I think when we look at terrorism and growing religious conservatism in Indonesia, you do have to realize that Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world, with more than 230 million Muslims in Indonesia. So in a way, it is quite reckless to use several incidents as a parameter and say that the entire country is heading towards a radical direction. So, and it is debatable whether religious tension in Indonesia is actually growing, but the indisputable reality is that at least it is showing up more. It is showing up more in conventional media. It is showing up more in discourses in social media. So regardless of whether or not it is actually growing, but we, people in Indonesia, is hearing about it more. And it's creating a narrative. And more cases of religious conflicts in communities are also being reported in Indonesia. There are separate incidents of churches not being approved of building permits in various areas in Java, in Sulawesi, in Sumatra. So it's quite a delicate situation. But I think, interestingly, this trend is somehow not really reflected in the political establishment. You know, since we haven't open presidential elections back in 2004, Indonesian Muslims don't really overwhelmingly vote for Islamic political parties in elections. And some study perceive this as that Islam is not really viewed by most Indonesians as an alternative establishment, but rather as a way to safeguard moral values. So in societies undergoing rapid social change, often there is, you know, concerns and pushback against and to safeguard tradition and customs. And it's not really surprising to see in Indonesia, which we have to remember that it has less than 20 years into its shift to democratization. But in recent years, there is certainly more pressure to conform to religious practices. I mean, compared to like 10 years ago, you would see more people wearing the hijab or more people performing 5 prayers and more people showing about it and boasting about it in social media. So yeah, it's again, if you talk about whether or not Indonesia has a growing religious tension, it's very, very difficult to really know about it. But ultimately, these kind of attacks are a wake-up call for the government. You know, and despite efforts to prevent and mitigate radical terrorist acts, one still got away and one is still one too many.
And do you think this will have serious economic implications, especially when it comes to things like investor confidence?
Yeah, of course. These kind of attacks will have an impact. But we do have to understand that although this is a very tragic incident, that these are still considered small scale. I mean, comparing to the Bali bombing that killed 200 people, now that event did really impact investor confidence. You know, investment and businesses in Bali were very like quiet. But overall, I think investors would pay more concern towards the structural problem that Indonesia has itself. Surveys conducted by Chamber of Commerce and Business Associations always noted that policy inconsistency and corruption are the main deterrent for businesses, not very much security concerns. So even in the middle of his second term, President Jokowi is still struggling with how he wants to cut the red tape, how he wants to deregulate sectors. I mean, although he has achieved quite applaudable efforts in simplifying regulations, but the fact is businesses and foreign investors still want to see more. They still want to see the negative investments being opened up. They still want less policy overlaps. Foreign businesses, when they want to do business in Indonesia, they still cite that they feel confused on who to engage, what the policies are, because this overlapping between what the central government is saying on an international platform and what the reality is on the ground. And you also have to keep in mind that despite the progress, Indonesia's ease of doing businesses is still quite stagnant. I think back in 2019, we were 73. Compared to Malaysia, it's 12. So the gap is huge. And don't forget about the corruption issues. I mean, even now, we're still seeing a lot of senior political figures, businesses being charged with corruption issues. So doing businesses in Indonesia is still not easy. And I think foreign investors would still see those as the main factors. I think with Bali is a rather unique case, is that before the Bali bombing, it was a hotspot for tourism and for investments pouring in. And despite the bombing, those advantages, those factors still continues to exist. So in a way, the fundamental factors with Bali, with the already growing population of expats living there, the factors are still there. Despite the hiccup that was the Bali bombing, the economy could recover quite quickly. And because it is tourism, it can really go back like quite quickly. But when you're talking about further or other incidents, like, for example, like in Surabaya and stuff, I think they would have much more difficulty in getting back investors confident because they do not have that tourism advantages that Bali has. So in a way, the recovery and the investors' confidence, they have to slowly build it up back again, employing more security measures, proving to investors that they have learned from it. For example, we take the example of Jakarta. After the bombing of the Marriott hotels, you suddenly see a revamp of security protocols. When you enter malls, you have to go through a metal screening. When you enter government official buildings, you have to go through metal screenings. And I just realized that when you go outside of Indonesia, that is actually not a norm, you know, to go through metal screenings. But for us Indonesians, yeah, we see it as something that is normal. And that is actually just one of the proof that Indonesians do learn from our mistakes. And we do try to make an effort in trying to restore investors' confidence and the international world's confidence in our capability to improve our own security measures. Yeah.
Okay, and how else has the government sought to tackle terrorism? Has it passed specific laws and other initiatives to improve national security?
So the government have always employed a dual measure, a combination of hard and soft approach. So hard approach would be passing on regulations, preventing measures like the Densus 88 operations in Makassar in January, which managed to capture several suspected terrorists, and soft approach. And this is where de-radicalization programs would take place, enforcing and empowering religious organizations to amp up their narrative game. However, the efforts that the government has made has been criticized as not being good enough. So I think our latest regulation on counterterrorism acts refers back to Law Number 5, 2018, on eradication of terrorist acts. And this was actually a big revamp. So police can now wiretap suspected terrorist suspects with only the approval of a court judge. They increased the detention duration for suspected terrorists. So there has been a major revamp in the hard approach. And even just back in January, Jokowi issued a presidential decree to strengthened the state's ability to collaborate for preventive measures. But it is the soft power, I think, soft approach that the government is still lacking. They are losing a battle in the narrative scene. It's very easy for people in Indonesia to open their social media to be consumed, to be overwhelmed with contents that are much more conservative in nature. But we haven't really seen the student organization, the two largest religious organizations, the Nahdlatul Ulama and the Muhammadiyah, to really provide a counter-narrative, to really go to the ground, to enhance their clerics, to enhance their preachers in spreading a more moderate view and de-radicalized people that have been radicalized. This is the one thing that they really need to amp up their game, I believe.
All right. So speaking of soft approach, do you think the education system should play a bigger role in strengthening national unity? I mean, here in Malaysia, when we talk about unity, a lot of the conversation is focused on reforming our schools, you know, that mutual respect starts in the classroom.
Yeah. Definitely, education will play an important role in preventing these future incidents. I mean, I remember when I was in school, we were always taught about tolerance and peace, but practicing it and internalizing it and living those lessons are a different ballgame, right? So it's not that we don't learn about tolerance and respect back in school, but sometimes children do not have the opportunity to practice it. I mean, I was fortunate to go to a Catholic school, so I was exposed to a different religion. I was exposed to different groups and to different societies. But I can imagine that for someone who probably lived their entire lives with Muslim families, with Muslim schoolmates, with Muslim neighbors, people of different religions can be somehow foreign to them. And, you know, the tolerance and empathy can only be internalized when you actually face people of different backgrounds, when you actually face people with different religions, and you understand that there are people that are different and they are still human beings. And I think this is what really missing from our education curriculum, is that we really enforce lessons on religions, but we don't really involve the Bhinneka Tunggal Ika aspect of it. You know, we don't really see cross study curriculums, you know, for Muslim students to probably spend some time studying in a Catholic school or in a Buddhist school or a Hindu school, just to grow empathy between children. Because the education system right now, they're facing a losing battle with influences from social media. Right now, children relatively have no boundaries and have no barriers of entry to enter this wide world and sometimes toxic world of social media. And what we know as a fact is that these extremist groups, these radical groups, have put forward a massive amount of resources in recruiting and spreading their narratives through social media. So the education system does need to be revamped, I think, to really internalize this living in harmony, Bhinneka Tunggal Ika aspect of the education, and try to fight a narrative with ones that are much more compassionate, filled with tolerance and a moderate view of religion. You know, Indonesia has this sacred saying of Bhinneka Tunggal Ika. unity in diversity, in that we do acknowledge that Indonesians are, there are numerous and hundreds of tribes, ethnicity in Indonesia, but all in all, we are one, we are Indonesian. And in the spirit of that, we do need to encourage much more cross-study. We need to encourage much more cross-living, learning with each other, and being exposed to other beliefs, other ethnicities, and other ways of lives, in the way that that is the way we teach tolerance, and that is the way we can combat the conservative narratives that is growing in social media.
Now, Alden, when the Surabaya bombings happened in 2018, the city's residents quickly came together and united in solidarity to condemn the attacks, and it was very remarkable. And this was also largely thanks to the former mayor's bravery and visibility. At the time, it was Tri Rismaharini. Do you foresee the same sort of healing happening in Makassar in the coming weeks?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think Mayor Risma did a remarkable job in handling that crisis. Well, she has always been a very hands-on person. And I think being a very popular figure in Surabaya, it does also help that she spearheads the healing process. But I have no doubts that the same thing will happen in Makassar. And I do believe that the people of Makassar will rise and will unite under this. And as I said before, that this is a really a wake-up call in that growing radicalism does not have a place in Indonesia, and that all aspects of society will fight against that.
Well, Eldon, on that note, thanks so much for speaking with us today. That was political analyst Eldon Iswanto joining us from Jakarta, and we discussed how the Indonesian government is tackling the threat of terrorism in its borders amid the latest church bombing, which happened yesterday in the city of Makassar.
Yeah, and it's interesting that when we talked about strengthening national unity in Indonesia, Alden brought up also brought up reforming the education system, which is a similar conversation that we have here in Malaysia, right?
Yeah.
But an interesting point that you brought, Hez, was how after the incident in Surabaya in 2018, the city actually got together very quickly to heal.
Yeah.
And I think you actually visited the city after the attacks happened, right?
Yeah, so for some context, I used to work for Karim Raslan, the political consultant, and full disclosure, Alden was actually my ex-colleague, and when I visited Surabaya, it was actually less than a week after the bombings had happened, and I was very scared to go.
Surely.
You know, because I mean, it was just so uncertain. But when I went to the ground, it was so interesting. Like, children were out in the public parks, people were back in the mall, people were eating at like the stalls at night. Like, I remember walking past like a jazz musicians actually playing, and I was just so surprised to see that people weren't afraid. And that was like I said, the governor back then was very vocal in coming out and saying, you know, we're not afraid, and we're going to unite, because Surabaya is a Muslim majority city. And it was just nice to see people showing that they weren't afraid and showing that, you know what, we're here for each other. This was an isolated attack, right? They didn't give voice to any group or any quarter. And it was just remarkable to see that you know, just by people going out, it just makes a difference.
Yeah,
it changes a lot.
I think communities are what, that's always what they try to do, right? Terrorize you, isn't it?
Yeah.
But when the community gets together, gosh, the things you can do.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it, community. And I think that was just a joy to see. And we're nice to travel, right, pre-COVID times. but, you know, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's show. But you can keep sharing your thoughts with us. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Send us a WhatsApp message on 018-789-8899. You can also look us up on Facebook on BFM The Bigger Picture to drop us a message. And if you missed any part of today's conversation, you can go ahead and download the podcast at bfm.my/daily digest or on the BFM app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. But do stick around, because coming up at 3 p.m. On this rainy Monday, Juliet is going to hang around for some Earth Matters to look at, you know, how our country should not be a garbage dump.
Yes, so this is actually in relation to all the illegal plastic recycling things that are coming into Malaysia from, right, you know, developed countries, and how Malaysia actually became a dumping ground for a lot of this. So I'll be speaking to Wong Pui Yi, who's a researcher from the C4 Centre, and Heng Kia Chun, who's from Greenpeace Malaysia. And they're going to talk about a report that was just released by C4, which is Citizens Against Corruption, Complacency, Crime, and the Climate Crisis. So that should be an interesting conversation. Stay tuned.
Yeah, so stick around for that after the 3 p.m. news. Once again, I'm Hezra Lashraf, alongside Juliet Jacobs and Dashran Johan. And you've been tuned in to the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.